Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. Transgender people face extraordinary levels of physical and sexual violence. According to the National Center for Transgender Equality, at least one in four trans people has faced a bias-driven assault, and rates are significantly higher for trans women of color. These assaults happen on the street, at work, in school, and at home. And in recent years, they've been on the rise. This hour, we're going to take a hard look at the persistence of such hate crimes and at the ongoing struggle for transgender rights and protections. Joining us this morning from Washington, D.C. is Charlotte Clymer. Clymer is a transgender activist, press secretary with the Human Rights Campaign, and an Army veteran. Charlotte, thanks so much for being a part of this conversation.
Good morning, Marianne. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. So, coming up later this hour, we'll also be joined by President of the Minneapolis City Council, Andrea Jenkins. And before we get started, I want to be clear that when we use the term transgender this hour, we're talking about trans men and women, but we're also talking about people who identify as non-binary or gender non-conforming. Charlotte, reports show that each year more than 20 transgender Americans are killed because of their gender identity. What is at the root of anti-transgender violence?
The root of it is essentially the way that we stigmatize transgender people. And the disinformation that's spread about the medical and psychological validity of transgender people. And, you know, more than that, it's the lack of support from much of the elected officials in our country.
So when we talk about this, let's go into a little bit more detail. When you talk about the lack of support from at the political level, what are we talking about here?
So, for example, since day one, the Trump-Pence White House has been attacking LGBTQ people in general, but specifically trans people. The Trump Department of Education has turned away school children who have brought forth civil rights complaints because of discrimination against them due to their being transgender. We of course know about the attempted ban on transgender members in the military by the Trump-Pence White House. And more recently in the fall, there was a story the New York Times broke about Trump's HHS looking into a administration-wide rule across all federal agencies to erase essentially transgender people from all federal protections.
When you look at that compared to, say, 2-3 years ago, it seems like there's been a stark shift in the treatment of transgender people in civil discourse.
Quite a bit. Quite a bit. I think that we were making quite a bit of progress. We've seen, you know, some minor victories. And not minor, I shouldn't say that. They're important, wonderful victories, but they are overshadowed by the just viciousness of this White House, and I would say the Republican Party in endorsing Trump's initiatives.
So what do you think is at, you know, we talked about this sort of backlash that you're facing. What do you think is at the root of the what's motivating these politicians to erase transgender identity?
I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of what it means to be transgender. There are quite a number of just myths out there about the trans community that are not dissimilar to past slander against the LGBTQ community in general. Of course, we see quite a bit of hate speech out there, especially from elected officials. It is this insistence on refusing to understand the nuance and the medical validity of trans people. And of course, that's been, you know, flying in the face of medical expertise for quite a while now. The American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, you know, the medical and scientific community has a consensus on affirming transgender people and our rights to live authentically and openly in society.
Do you think fear has something to do with it?
Oh, quite a bit. Yeah, it is something that folks don't understand. And when we don't understand something, it scares us. I don't think that excuses, however, this refusal to engage with the trans community and understand our stories. You know, we're just like anyone else. We serve in the military. We pay taxes. We're doctors, lawyers, public school teachers. We span the breadth of society, and not just in the United States, but all around the world. You know, you go anywhere in the world, you'll find transgender people.
We're talking this hour about the persistence of violence against transgender people and the ongoing struggle for transgender rights and protections. And we'd like to hear from you. If you identify as transgender, what do you need to feel safe? What do you think is at the cause of anti-transgender violence? If you're a parent of a transgender child, what are your concerns? You can give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Charlotte, you served in the military before you transitioned. What do you think of the ban on transgender people serving in the military?
Oh, it has no merit whatsoever. You know, it's interesting. When Donald Trump announced the ban via Twitter without consulting his military leadership, he initially cited the financial cost. We found that to be entirely without merit. The RAND Institute released a report estimating the cost of transgender-related health care. And what they found was that it would be, you know, less than a fraction of a percent of the overall expenditures that the military dedicates toward health care costs for service members. Then it was, of course, the old fallback of unit cohesion and readiness. What's interesting about that is that last year when Senator Kirsten Gillibrand questioned every service chief before the Senate Armed Services Committee, she simply asked them, you know, do you find that transgender service members serving openly has any effect on unit cohesion readiness? And to a person, they all said no. They had found no problems with it. They had certainly found no effect on, you know, unit readiness. And then it becomes something along the lines of a broader cultural stigmatization, right? Which again is what we talked about before in putting forth these, you know, ridiculous myths about the validity of transgender people in the medical and psychological context. Mm-hmm. I will say that it breaks my heart that there are transgender people serving at this very moment overseas, and their commander in chief is essentially not only insulting their service, but undermining their authority in combat zones. We have officers who are transgender in combat zones who are leading troops, and they need the confidence of their commander-in-chief to do their job. And that's lacking at the moment. Mm.
You also experienced an incident of basically being... you weren't assaulted, but you were put in a situation where you had a restaurant, was it just over a year ago, and were asked for your ID. Talk a little bit about what happened.
Sure. Well, and, you know, it was pretty traumatic. I was at a friend's bachelorette party, and it was about 10 or 11 of us. We went to a restaurant in downtown D.C., having a great time. Everyone was having a, you know, wonderful time celebrating our friend. And near the end of the evening, I went to use the restroom, and there was an attendant who asked for my ID. Now, he didn't ask any of the other women who were going into the restroom. He kind of specifically singled me out, and I thought I didn't hear him at first. And, you know, there's this thing where, as a trans person, it almost feels like you're being gaslighted most of the time, because sometimes people are rude because they're just rude, and sometimes they're rude because, you know, you're transgender. They're mm-hmm. being transphobic. So I wanted to make sure I wasn't overreacting, and so I asked him again, well, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, and he said, I need to see your ID. I said, no, of course, that's ridiculous, and I, you know, turned on my heel and walked into the restroom. I go inside to do my business, and I hear him come into the restroom and start trying to check every stall. For me, this is a cisgender male who's just tried to block me from going to the restroom. And now he feels comfortable going in and, you know, checking all these stalls.
And we should just know for people who don't know the term cisgender, that that's somebody who is identifies with the gender they're born into. Go ahead.
That's correct. Yeah. So I finish my business and I walk out to both he and the manager now asking for my ID. And you have to understand, this is a very crowded hallway in a crowded restroom. You know, we're blocking the entranceway. There's a lot of people looking at this, a lot of women as well who are behind me trying to get out. And he insists on seeing my ID. And I said, that's first of all, it's illegal and it's incredibly insulting. He continues to persist. Instead of making a scene, what I decided to do was go outside, look up the law on my phone. I went back inside to show him, you know, this is illegal what you're doing. You can't, you know, it's not in accordance with D.C. law, which, you know, is trans-affirming. He at some point threatened to call the police, and I told him he should. He absolutely should. That's when he called over his bouncer to throw me out. His bouncer grabs me and, you know, just kind of throws me outside the restaurant. Now, fortunately, this has a happy ending. I called the police. They responded. DC police were completely professional and affirming. They, of course, let the manager know that what he did was completely wrong. We brought a civil rights complaint against the restaurant. And I got to say, the CEO of the restaurant really worked with us to not only resolve this situation, but ensure it doesn't happen again. And we had a happy resolution. But what has made me think about this a lot is that most folks in the United States don't have access to these non-discrimination protections. Mm-hmm. You know, in D.C., we have the Human Rights Act, which provides universal protections for folks regardless of their gender identity or sexual orientation. And that's not the case for, you know, folks living in most of the United States.
Yeah. And most people are not the press secretary for the Human Rights Campaign and can say, oh, no, I actually have the law right here. I can show you where this is.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And most folks don't have a large platform in which they can talk about these things.
Yeah.
You know, I worry a lot about folks even in D.C. who may be discriminated against but don't understand the law.
Mm-hmm. And talking about that in D.C., D.C. is known for being a relatively liberal community compared to the rest of the United States.
That's correct. In fact, a study released by the Williams Institute yesterday found that about 10% of D.C. is LGBTQ, which is the most in the entire country. We can lay claim to being the most queer city in the country. And so for this to happen kind of was a wake-up call to everyone that we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. And just imagine what the situations might appear like in a more rural town in the Midwest compared to a metropolitan city. We're talking this hour.
Or Central Texas, where I'm from.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Right. We're talking this hour about the persistence of violence against transgender people and the ongoing struggle for transgender rights and protections. If you'd like to join the conversation with your experience, if you have a family member or a loved one who is transgender, what are your concerns? Give us a call at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, or 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you work in the schools, what are your concerns about helping transgender youth in their making their way through the education system? Give us a call and share your story. Charlotte, a lot of this starts at home. I mean, the violence that transgender people experience comes as a result of a long list of other discriminations. And it often starts, one of them is homelessness, because trans youth have faced rejection at home. As we talk about more about these issues, is acceptance for trans youth gaining ground?
It is gaining ground, but it's moving ever too slowly, just as with every aspect of the LGBTQ movement. And that's something that we all have to work to improve. But what we do know is that LGBTQ youth face higher rates of homelessness. They face higher rates of discrimination in schools, acts of violence, abuse within their own homes. There's still this broad stigmatization that we have not yet addressed. And so we have a lot of work to do when it comes to ensuring that every child, regardless of who they are, feel safe not only in their schools, but also their wider communities.
Mm. I'd now like to welcome to the conversation Councilwoman Andrea Jenkins. She's the vice president of the Minneapolis City Council. Councilwoman Jenkins, it's great to have you back.
Good morning, Marianne. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Andrea, trans women of color make up 80% of transgender homicides. That's just such a startling number. What do you take to be the reason for the disparity?
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you, Marianne, for hosting this conversation. And good morning to Charlotte.
Good morning, Councilwoman. It's an honor to talk with you on here. I'm a big fan.
Well, thank you so much. And I did want to just note, you introduced me just now as vice president, but earlier I heard my name as the president of the city council, so I just wanted to make sure that we are clear in my role
as
the vice president, which I'm very proud to be.
Excellent.
And so, you know, I think 80% of the violence being perpetrated against trans people are impacting African-American trans people and predominantly trans women, and it is horrific. So it really, though, I think sort of highlights the intersection of race and gender and sexuality and how that plays out in our culture and society. And even when you look at the violence in the broader LGBT community, most of it, again, is perpetrated against transgender women of color. It makes up those numbers. And so I think it's a number of the issues that Charlotte has mentioned earlier around homelessness, which is a major factor. And that is impacted by people's ability to earn income for themselves. And so if you're not able to be, you know, a productive, you know, employed member of society, and it's not that these folks don't have skills and or drive or perseverance, is that they are not being let into the workplaces or being harassed out of the workplace. And so, you know, I think there's a number of factors, but poverty, homelessness, and certainly, you know, I heard Charlotte talking about the political climate under this current administration that has been contributing to these issues, and then particularly the discrimination that's happening in schools against trans youth, which is where I think a lot of the vitriol and conversation is happening, unfortunately, right now in our schools.
Andrea, I know you work in the realm of policy. What needs to change to provide transgender people with more stability? I mean, were you talking housing, employment, et cetera?
So, you know, I've been working in the realm of policy for a long time, and we have job training programs that are targeted towards specific communities all the time, dislocated workers programs, underserved youth programs, you know, programs for different language speakers. We have no training programs specifically for gender nonconforming and transgender identified people. And I'm really glad that you brought up this issue of gender nonconformity too, because I think, you know, the statistics in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, state that 3% of all students in schools now identify as gender nonconforming. And that, in my mind, is a very, very high number. So I think we need targeted training programs. We need housing that is specifically targeted towards transgender and gender nonconforming and LGBT youth, which is they make up the highest percentage of unhoused people or housing unstable folks. And so those are some of the policies that I think could really be helpful.
We're talking this hour about transgender rights and breaking the cycle of violence against the transgender community. And we, of course, we'd like to hear from you. If you identify as transgender, what do you need to feel safe? What policies would you like to see put in place? And for your experience, what is at the cause of anti-transgender violence? You can become a part of the conversation when you call 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to the phones. We've got Celia on the line in Minneapolis. Celia, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thank you.
Absolutely.
So I am the parent of a trans middle schooler, And it's been a really wonderful, painful, fascinating journey, really, as we've begun to navigate this really only over the past 6 months. And so I feel really lucky that we have been in Minneapolis public schools that so far has been really nothing but supportive, and has immediately offered the ability to change his name, offered him the ability to use single stall bathrooms right away. And so I really am thankful for that. And we've been able to find resources, medical resources within Hennepin Healthcare for him to get counseling and pediatric gender medical treatment. And so I'm thankful that we've had resources, and I'm thankful that he's been able to have these things so early in his life that hopefully he'll be able to be comfortable for longer. And it's a double-edged sword, because at the same time, I am now cognizant of all of the ways that he can now move in through this world and have more discomfort and ways in which his safety is compromised. And so even though I know that he has support and I know that there are ways that we can help him feel better in his life, I worry about sending him out to do things and him worried about where he can go to the bathroom, because I know the bathroom is such a huge issue. And for things like travel, you know, when he worries about when we fly internationally, does my picture on my passport, my name on my passport, doesn't match with how I present? And as a youth, all of these things are so much more challenging for him to navigate, because he's still just developing identity, even as a human, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, as any parent wants to protect their kids, but when it's a trans kid, it seems like the fear grows even that much more exponentially when you look at the statistics out there. Charlotte, did you want to add something?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, I'll say thank you so much for calling in. And just not only, I'm not going to thank you for being a great parent, because I know you would never want me to do that, but I just want to thank you for your outspoken labor on this and making sure that more people know about it. It means a lot.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know,
Andrea, go ahead.
This is Andrea. Yeah. Again, thank you, Celia. And I don't know, you're here locally, so you talked about Minneapolis Public Schools. I hope you're engaged with transforming families, or if not, they are a very supportive group of parents and young people who are, you know, navigating some of the same issues that you are. And, you know, I've been involved with a number of organizations trying to deal with housing issues for young people, so Point Source for Youth and Reclaim and other organizations that are really trying to take care of the whole person, thinking about mental health and physical health and housing and employment opportunities, and trying to support those kinds of programs and projects. But, you know, there is still a lot of work to be done, and I think there is a lot of support for young people today, and we just have to be really vocal. You mentioned earlier on, Marianne, about the National Center for Transgender Equality's report, and they also report that 70% of transgender youth who have the support of their families really do much better, don't have those issues around homelessness and employment and being able to access school, as do a lot of folks that don't have that kind of family support. So I want to commend you, Celia, for standing by your son and helping him to navigate these really challenging issues.
Before we go any further, I want to go right to the phones. We've got Becky on the line in Woodbury. Becky, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on the call. I'm a big fan of Andrea.
Excellent.
Thank you, Becky.
done so much for our community. I just wanted to comment on the ARC. I transitioned 20 years ago, and the national conversation these days, there's much more awareness that transgender folks exist, and much more, it seems like there's much more permission to be anti-transgender, and as there is for a lot of other folks in minority positions. But in the local scene, it seems like, compared to when I transitioned 20 years ago, there's a lot more queer community support, and even more support amongst other parts of LGBTQA plus community than there was. And so it seems like there's this dichotomy where we're kind of more harassed nationally and maybe more supported locally. I just would like to hear comment, you know, any reactions to that kind of comment. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Becky. Andrea, what do you think?
So, I absolutely think that's true, having come out a few years before you did, Becky. So I've been an out trans woman in this community for a long time, and so there absolutely has been a lot more support here locally and activism. And in fact, we talked about policies. You know, I didn't mention, because it's already policy, that we have, in Minneapolis at least, changed to allow for single stall gender fluid bathrooms or non-gendered bathrooms, as it were. And so we're about to embark on a education campaign to let restaurant owners and other establishments know that they can do this, and then help them with signage. That's a huge step forward from where we were 30 years ago. Minnesota has always been a leader in supporting and protecting transgender rights through policy. We were the first state to have a Human Rights Act that specifically included transgender Minnesotans as a quote protected class. And so we've kind of had these policies, and we've been extending it more, but the national rhetoric has been impacting the local community, I think, and
how so?
It is really disheartening to hear that, you know, people are being kicked out of the military when we already have a shortage of people who are stepping up and volunteering to be a part of our armed services forces, and we're kicking people out because of their gender identity. This is something that, armed forces all around the world have recognized as just common sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we had too for a certain amount of time. I really think this backlash against transgender people is really an effort to, clearly it's to appeal to this small base of people that support this current administration. But I think also it's a deflection to keep people preoccupied with nonsense while this administration is doing all sorts of devious and criminal acts to undermine our democracy.
Thanks for that, Andrea. Charlotte, what's your take on this and how things stand? You know, things vary state by state pretty dramatically in terms of protections for the transgender community. Can you give us sort of a sense of what the extremes are on either end in terms of protected versus unprotected?
I'm so glad you brought that up. And Becky, thank you for pointing out that so many of us in large metropolitan areas have those rights. But folks nationally, and in fact in 30 states, transgender people and LGBTQ people in general are at risk of being fired, refused housing, or denied services simply because of who we are. If I start driving in San Francisco and I end up in New York, the rights that I'm entitled to will change numerous times based on whatever state I'm driving through. Whenever I travel, if I go to another state or another town, another state, I make sure I know statewide protections and local protections. And that's something that's fairly common among LGBTQ people and transgender people in particular. is that we have to know what kind of protections we'll have when we travel to another place. And I think it's important to bring up because next week we're introducing, well, not we, but the Equality Act is being introduced in the House and Senate. And that is a bill that would essentially provide LGBTQ protections across the board at the federal level. And it would strengthen protections for all people, including women, religious minorities, and, of course, folks of color. I mean, we're talking about employment, housing, credit, education, federally funded programs. And, you know, it's something that is it's very important for folks who are listening to make sure that you call your members of Congress and ensure they know that not only is the Equality Act needed, but, you know, we need folks to co-sponsor it and be vocal to their colleagues in the House and the Senate to make sure it passes.
Given the current political climate, what hope do you have for it passing?
I think it'll pass the House easily. I'm not sure that Senator McConnell will bring it to the floor, which is unfortunate because it has broad bipartisan support. You know, 70% of Americans support passing federal protections for LGBTQ people, including a majority of Republicans. It has unprecedented support from hundreds of lawmakers, a record number of businesses and corporations, and more than 180 national and statewide organizations have signed on to support it. So it is pretty clear that the vast majority of Americans support this legislation. And so I would hope that the majority leader, Senator McConnell, will bring it to the floor of the Senate, allow it to be passed, and it'll go to Donald Trump's desk.
We're talking this hour about transgender rights and protections. And if you are involved or affected by these rights and protections, if you identify as transgender, if you have a family member who is a child, or if you work in education and other issues in which you come into contact with transgender students, we'd love to hear from you about your concerns and where you think we've made progress, where you think we're falling backward. You can give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000, or you can reach us at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Andrea Jenkins, do you sometimes worry that because you and others have achieved high-profile status or been elected to office that people think, oh, we fixed that issue? You know, similar to President Obama's election, inspiring people to say that we were living in a post-racial America.
You know, I actually do think that is certainly a possibility that a number of people feel that way. I think it's unfortunate because it hasn't really shifted the dialogue that much. And in fact, it potentially has, you know, my visibility, other people who are very visible, like, you know, Laverne Cox or my colleague here on the city council, Philippe Cunningham. I mean, I think that kind of awareness, while we certainly get, you know, praise and accolades or whatever that is, a lot of people experience discrimination and hatred because of that. And so, you mentioned President Obama, and in my experience, racism ratcheted up when he was elected, and I think because of the very rationale that you named, that we elected a black man to be president, so now we can do and say whatever we want to, And unfortunately, some of those same kinds of sentiments are reflected in the transgender and gender nonconforming communities.
Charlotte, is that something that you see, that with greater exposure? I think Becky was talking this a little bit, that the more the higher profile that trans people get, in some ways it creates a backlash?
Well, yes, I do believe that. I think it's more a disparity in perception, right? We see trans people who are highly visible in film and television. We see folks like Andrew Jenkins and Danica Rome in Virginia who are elected. I mean, I think we have four trans women who are now state legislators in the country. which is a wonderful accomplishment. But also last year, 26 trans women were killed, the majority of them being women of color.
Mm-hmm.
When I was discriminated against last year at the D.C. restaurant, you know, I'm a white trans woman who's a military veteran, who has a college education. And so it was very easy for people to ally with me. But what's unfortunate is that racism, ableism, xenophobia gets in the way. And so that folks who are trans and people of color or persons with disabilities religious minorities, they see the discrimination and gets them compounded.
Mm.
And so I think it's not the same for all of us. You know, trans women of color have a far, far, far worse experience than I do in this country. And unless we're addressing that, then we're not really helping the trans community overall.
Mm-hmm. I was shocked to learn recently that 47 states have what's called a gay and trans panic defense.
Mm-hmm.
Charlotte Clymer, can you explain exactly what that is and how it works?
Meaning that if you kill a member of the LGBTQ community, you can claim that it was because you felt they were hitting on you, or you felt threatened by a romantic interest. Essentially, it's just a way to allow for LGBTQ people to be targeted with violence and discrimination, using the way that we stigmatize. People who are afraid or fear being hit on by LGBTQ people.
It's interesting that that exists, but we don't have an equivalent for women being hit on by men.
No, we don't,
exactly.
Do we?
Yeah,
cisgender women. It's even beyond just being hit on, which is horrific when you think about it, but the transgender panic defense has been mostly used when people have had sex with transgender people and then mm-hmm. murdered them afterwards, which is...
Sex workers especially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when that panic defense has been mostly employed, and which is just unconscionable when you think about it. So, but yes, we should have an equivalent for women who are being hit on as well.
We shouldn't have either, I think, is the case here. And here in Minnesota, a measure to ban this defense was introduced last year. It has yet to pass. Are there many efforts to get these sorts of defenses thrown out of court?
Well, I would certainly like to be a part of any effort. I am not aware of a broad movement here in Minnesota, but...
How about nationally, Charlotte?
Well, I'm not particularly aware of this issue. Mm-hmm. I think that we've been focused on housing discrimination, all these, you know, other peripheral things that deal with LGBTQ people and trans people in general. But, I mean, this is another thing that the Equality Act would help address.
Yeah.
Getting federal legislation passed that protects everyone, regardless of the zip code you live in, would prevent, for example, you know, a trans woman of color being murdered because she's a sex worker and an engagement goes wrong.
Mm.
The way that we stigmatize trans bodies and tell, you know, the American public that it's okay to kill trans women is something that should weigh heavily on all our conscience and compel us to take action. You know, no one should feel unsafe in this country just because of their gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Charlotte, you just hit on a really important point, and I just want to make this point around intersectionality, because I think this attack on women's bodies generally and who has agency over mm-hmm. what people do with their bodies plays into this broader conversation around gender identity and who has the rights and agency to have control over their bodies, and which is why it's important for us, you know, for myself as a transgender activist to be speaking up for reproductive rights and immigrant rights and disability rights, because all of these issues around agency and sort of personal decision making about one's own body plays in together, and certainly, Charlotte, you mentioned race and racism, which also is incredible, plays an incredible role in the harassment and violence that is perpetrated against transgender women of color, mm-hmm. immigrant women. And so all of these things are interconnected, which is, you know, that is my message when I'm out talking about these issues. And we have to recognize that.
Andrea,
and Councilwoman, can I?
Together.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I add something really quickly? Because the Councilwoman just brought up a great point. I think there's also a lack of perception in the progressive community on the experiences of trans women. You know, I've met some wonderful progressive people who do support the trans community in general, but they don't understand what we go through. I was talking to a friend 2 months ago who was under the impression that trans women aren't street harassed or that we don't face discrimination in pay or that we aren't sexually harassed via online. Mm. And so I would say that, you know, we do share these experiences with cisgender women. And this is the kind of thing that would be more widely known if we did better engagement, and that if, you know, cisgender allies, you know, just put a little more effort into understanding our experiences and what we go through, because it's so completely similar to women in general.
Yeah.
And I think that unless we have each other's backs, then, you know, we're all left behind.
Well, and International Women's Day is coming up on Friday, where we mm-hmm. celebrate all women. Are we seeing progress for transgender women being accepted by other women, especially in the feminist and Me Too movements, Andrea?
Well, you know, personally, I have. You know, I've been invited many times over the years to, you know, last year I spoke at the Women's March. This year I'm speaking on International Women's Day and all kinds of events. But I'm not sure that all trans-identified women are having that. And there does seem to be some backlash internationally and nationally from feminist groups that are, you know, opposed to gender identities and transgender women and men, for that matter. But it is. It's this weird dichotomy of every step of progress, there's sort of two steps of sort of...
One step forward, two steps back?
Anti mm-hmm. or transphobia. And,
yeah.
and we're right in the midst of that right yeah. now. And it's just, it's frustrating as well as... inspiring, you know, there's a lot of work to do and there's a lot of support out there. But, yeah, we're in this sort of weird, I don't know.
Hmm. Well, speaking of work to do,
right now.
Andrea, speaking of work to do, I know you need to get to a meeting. So
absolutely.
You need, yeah, so I'll let you go. But thank you so much for joining us this hour. We really appreciate
it. Thank you for hosting this conversation. It's a really important dialogue. Thank you for, I think, including it in this national, international sort of celebration of women I look forward to speaking with you again.
All right, Andrea. You take care.
Goodbye.
Charlotte, moving on, and I'd love to get your take on the place for transgender women in the broader feminist movement and the Me Too movement and what can be done to maybe to create more room for transgender women in that movement, those movements.
Well, you know, I certainly don't speak for all trans people. You know, if you, you know, ask, you know, any given trans woman, they might have a different experience or anecdotal engagements. But I would say that overall, the vast majority of the feminist movement and certainly the vast majority of cisgender women do support trans women
yeah.
And transgender rights in general. There was a recent poll done in five major cities across the world. I believe it was Tokyo, New York, Cairo, and two others that I'm forgetting. But what they found is, you know, regardless of culture and geographic location, cisgender women overwhelmingly supported trans women and their inclusion and rights. I will say from my personal standpoint, you know, when I came out and, you know, when I had that instance of discrimination last year, It was women who reached out and gave support to me. Chelsea Clinton, Muriel Bowser, the mayor of D.C., hundreds of messages from women across the country and around the world, cisgender women who wanted to make sure that they knew that they viewed me as a sister and as someone who is a woman and part of the struggle overall. And so, yes, there is a very, 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 very small, and I do not mean to understate this because it shouldn't be understated. It's incredibly small fraction of women who call themselves feminists, and they're not, who are opposed to trans equality. But I think they are broadly and overwhelmingly overrun by the number of feminist women who have come out in support of trans equality.
Mm. We have just a couple of minutes left, and we haven't talked at all about healthcare. And I'm just wondering, in terms of care for transgender people, if there where their progress has been made and where we're falling behind.
Well, the one place we're falling behind is specifically with this administration. Trump and Pence have attempted to introduce a rule through HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, that would essentially allow medical providers to deny even life-saving health care to LGBTQ patients based on the medical provider's personal beliefs. And that's across the board. That's not just trans-related health care. And so if I go into a hospital and, let's say it's a dire emergency and I'm bleeding or really bleeding profusely or have some kind of life-threatening injury, under this rule, a doctor could say, you know, this person's gender identity goes against my personal beliefs. I don't feel comfortable treating them. And under this rule, that would be legal. When I tell people this, they think it's an exaggeration or that I'm lying, but this is an actual policy that has been offered by the Trump-Pence administration. And I wish more people knew about it, because this speaks to the way in which this White House and the Republican Party have aggressively invalidated trans identities and trans people, not only from the way that we receive equal rights in schools and in the workplace and in the military, but down to the most essential human right, which is the right to live. So I wish more people knew about that, and I wish more people were supporting the Equality Act and would call their members of Congress and make sure that they support it too.
And with that, I think we need to bring our hour to a close. Charlotte, thank you so much for taking the time with us this hour. It's been I've learned a lot. And yeah, I really appreciate your taking the time to help people understand these issues.
Marianne, I appreciate you so much. Thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. We've been talking with Charlotte Clymer. Charlotte is an Army vet, a transgender activist, and press secretary with the Human Rights Campaign. We also spoke earlier this hour with Minneapolis City Councilwoman Andrea Jenkins.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.